Welcome to Streaming Thoughts, where we stream our thoughts on movies, TV, and all things nerdy. I am Daniel.
And I am Nathan.
And welcome to our podcast. So Nathan, what is in the news docket today?
Well, I got some good news, bad news, COVID related.
All right.
Well, AMC, that has been rumored to be on the verge of bankruptcy for a little while now, has reported its third quarter losses yet again, which is kind of expected given their struggle reopening and convincing people it's safe to return to theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is it's about 9 times less than what market analytics was predicting their losses would be.
9 times less, that's not bad.
So still losses, but not as bad as it could be.
That's not bad. I mean, if we were expecting worse and that's not what we got, that's a win in my book.
And on that, I mean, jumping back to our typical topics of casting news and boomerang back to a previous 2 episodes. Previously, we talked about how Superman was being considered for a role in the upcoming James Bond film, right?
Yes, Henry Cavill.
Even further back, we talked about Maria Rambeau from Captain Marvel being considered for a role in the next James Bond film.
That's right.
Well, Maria Rambeau, aka the actor Lashana Lynch, has gone on the record confirming that she is the one cast as 007.
Really? Wow. I was not expecting that. That's great.
Actually, I'm kind of excited about this because I actually really hope that this is finally the movie that they confirm that James Bond 007 is a hand-in-hand code name for the spy rather than just James Bond is his real name and 007 is a code name. No, I want both to be the code name. She is assigned these to work for MI6 because that way it puts all the other James Bond in a canon just saying, yep, Sean Connery's James Bond retired, and then you have the Roger Moore James Bond, and then he retired, and all that other things. It all plays out.
Right? I thought it was an alias, right? Like every 007 is James Bond. That's kind of how I always took it.
That's how I always took it too, just to make headcanon of the regularly changing actors, but it's never officially been stated in the films.
I want to say at least the Pierce Brosnan Bonds from that era forward, to me that seems like they are all connected, considering that Judi Dench has played M pretty much since those movies.
Right. I mean, the original Daniel Craig one almost had the chance to confirm it when they kind of did it as a origin story for Daniel Craig, but they still granted him the codename of 007, but not necessarily that James Bond went along with it. They needed to kind of tie both of them together.
Yeah. The way that they have approached this 007 since Craig has been, I think, a little bit better than the previous ones. I mean, we kind of saw a big decline since GoldenEye in 007, you know, movie quality. The last few of Pierce Brosnan were just laughable. They were really bad.
They weren't necessarily the greatest, but I mean, I still appreciate the fact that it was still the super spy, high 30 minutes in the future technology sort of things.
Yeah, exactly.
That was something I was missing a bit with the original Daniel Craig Bond. I don't know how the later Daniel Craig Bonds came out because I didn't watch the later ones. I didn't really like him as James Bond too much. He never really captured that sleek, stylish Bond for me.
Right. I think that was the point, right? The point of these films was meant to be a new era of James Bond that I think was inspired heavily by other spy franchises that came before him. Like, let's be real here, the Bourne trilogy also, in my mind, heavily inspired this new Bond in terms of it being more action-paced.
I mean, then that's the thing. It's like, I like the Bourne movies, but I like the Bourne movies because they're Bourne movies. I like the Bond movies because they're Bond movies. I don't want or need Bond movies to be like the Bourne movies.
Right, there's a certain look and feel to Bond movies, a certain set of expectations. You know, the Daniel Craig Bond is definitely the more action-packed, the more doing stunts. It's like they grab the combination of both Jason Bourne and Mission Impossible, and they're like, what if we added a little bit of both of these to the Bond franchise? And for a lot of us, we were like, yeah, that sounds great. But for some, like you, maybe you're like, no, I didn't like that. I wanted Bond because Bond was Bond. Bond was not Ethan Hunt, and Bond was not Jason Bourne. Bond is Bond.
Exactly, exactly. And I understand, he's been popular for many people. All credit to them. You don't have to like every single, especially something that is as widespread with as many different interpretations as the Bond franchise. I don't think any Bond fan needs to be a fan of every type of Bond. I know I've met plenty of people that absolutely hate the Roger Moore Bond, for example. So, I mean, it's...
Right.
It is what it is.
For sure.
Here's another question for you, though. Are you a fan of Star Trek?
What? No. I hate that series.
Seriously?
No, of course I love it. Go on.
Are you keep trying to convince yourself to buy a 3D printer so you can 3D print nerdy stuff?
You know, I honestly would spend so many hours in that, that that's why I probably don't want to ever get a 3D printer.
Well, to steal a term from Kyle Hill's previous job, some super nerds were messing around with a 3D printer, and they 3D printed a USS Voyager that can move under its own power that is only 5 micrometers big. It is so small you can only really see it with an electron microscope.
You know, the most amazing part about that to me is the fact that I had no idea that 3D printers could print something that small.
Well, I mean, obviously they're specially type 3D printers. I mean,
sure, you can't buy this one at Micro Center, I'm sure, but...
But man, the idea that we have gotten down to basically 3D printing on such a small scale creates this whole new environment for working with science and everything else. It's just like, it blows the mind like that this is even a thing that you could control that fine of detail.
I mean, it legitimately sounds like something out of a Marvel movie, right?
Yeah, this is how Tony made his Infinity Armor.
Right. Exactly.
Other non-movie but totally nerdy things. Did you know that about 7 months ago, an Australian radio antenna had to go under repairs and we lost contact with Voyager 2?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, Voyager 2, it's out in interstellar space, just cruising along, and we lost contact because one of our primary radio telescopes for radio antennas for maintaining contact had to be shut down for repairs, and it took 7 months to complete the repairs. In those 7 months, if anything happened, like too many cosmic radiation on one side of it, a faulty component reheating one side of the Voyager more than the other side, at that interstellar space could drastically alter its course, and it is currently 11.6 billion miles from Earth. So just a fraction of a change from its projected course could mean that we lost contact forever.
Yeah, space is big, y'all.
Yes, space is big. Even like a tenth of or a hundredth of a degree on Earth becomes thousands of miles once you get out that far.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're limited by the speed of light for communication. That takes over 17 hours to get a signal out there and then another 17 hours to get a signal back, which is why it's really cool that they were able to reestablish contact once they had that antenna back up and running.
That would have been a very big tragedy if we had lost contact with Voyager 2. The cultural significance of Voyager 2 is immeasurable.
We have to maintain contact with Voyager. We don't want it coming back as V'ger.
Yeah. I mean, it does have our address in there.
Right? A lot of people I was seeing online weren't understanding why it was such a big deal that we reestablished contact. Like, well, would it just be the same path as where we expected it to be? It's like, well, not necessarily. I mean,
ideally.
7 months in interstellar space, any number of things could have happened that would have made us lose contact, and just a few fractions of a degree, it would have been gone forever.
Yes, absolutely. And if you want to see a story set in space or another planet that is just an amazing film, check out The Martian if you want something like that. Fantastic film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Time back to movies, which is what we do here.
Well, jumping back to movie news, Greece has selected the movie they are going to submit for the International Feature Film Oscar race.
Greece,
the country of Greece.
What is the movie?
They have selected a movie. It has already opened in the Venice Film Festival.
Okay.
It is called Apples, and it's about a man struggling to recover his memory in the midst of a pandemic that causes widespread amnesia.
Oh, great. I hope that's not COVID-20.
Right. I mean, the pandemic, you know, makes me wonder if that, maybe that's why, kind of current to the times, why they selected that one. But, you know, the best things that have ever come out of Greece is Greek mythology. I mean, let's just be honest. Can we tie Greek mythology into your films a little bit?
Right. I mean, can we tie Greek mythology to a Netflix original animated series? Is it possible that we can do that?
Absolutely, we can.
Yeah, and this is Blood of Zeus. I think it was called Gods and Heroes, if I'm not mistaken. That was the original title of it. It's a Netflix original animated television series. It is an adult animated television series. I want to make sure so that just in case you're thinking, hey, maybe I could sit down with my kids and watch this one. Don't.
Oh, no.
If you thought Castlevania was violent, you ain't seen nothing.
This was definitely one I was a little slow in watching in preparation for this podcast, because it was always making sure my kids were well asleep and in bed before I turned this one on, because I didn't want them walking in on some of these fight scenes. This is a brutal, violent, and graphic fight scenes in this, especially for animation.
Yeah, they really went the extra mile with the details and the gore. I mean, like, cool, but also, was it necessary? To go that extra mile, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was.
It almost felt like they were trying to test themselves. Like, how far can we push the gore and animation?
Right. I don't think that specific aspect of the show served any real good purpose. I thought it was mainly just to see, like you were saying, mainly just to see how far they could push, it seemed like, at times. So
it was definitely gore for the sake of having gore, I think, in a lot of places. And you mentioned Castlevania. This is by the same crew as Castlevania, right?
That's right. Yes. It's by the same animator, or the same animation studio that brought Castlevania. And you can see it, right? I mean, you can see it in the animation style, that this is very reminiscent of Castlevania.
Now, I'm pretty sure I didn't miss it, but maybe I did. This is not connected to their backdoor connected universe, right?
Look, I'm not going to be surprised if somehow this makes it into the bootleg multiverse.
Bootleg multiverse, that's it. Yeah, I didn't see anything that hinted that it was, but
I didn't either, you know, but in a world where vampires exist, who's to say we can't add Greek gods to that whole mythology? I mean, we already got vampires and all kinds of creatures. Why not throw in some Greek gods and all that?
Why not, right?
Yeah.
So, Daniel, what did you think of Blood of Zeus?
Blood of Zeus is a pretty good animated series, I thought. I think that it's a pretty good attempt at capturing the Greek myths and integrate them into an animated series in the same way that Castlevania was trying to integrate, you know, the rich background and history of the Castlevania video game series into an animated format. And I think that this one, for the most part, did a pretty good job at that. I think that, in my mind, also the score was epic in a lot of ways. I mean, you just saw that whole, it really convey the whole, we are dealing with gods here, with the epicness of that they were trying to go for. So at least the score for me was pretty great. The animation, the action, all of it, I thought was really well done. I think, as we just mentioned, a little over the top with the gore there from time to time, but for the most part, the action sequences were pretty well done. But what about you, Nathan? What did you think of it?
Overall, in some ways, you could kind of argue that this was a retelling of Disney's Hercules movie, changing it so that Hera is the proper villain instead of Hades.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting choice.
Well, it's a lot more true to the interpolitics of Greek mythology.
Right.
In the modern day, we always want to paint Hades as a bad guy because he oversees the underworld and the underworld is hell. But he didn't just oversee hell of Greek mythology, he also oversaw heaven of Greek mythology.
Right.
He was the lord of both. They were the same place, just one was pleasant and one was unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories in Greek mythology where the gods of Olympus didn't really want to deal with Hades too much, and he was always kind of the outcast, but he was rarely a true villain in the sense. It was more so Hera's jealousy and anger that was driving a lot of the conflicts amongst the Greek gods, possibly rightfully so, because Zeus is kind of a horn dog millionaire.
Yeah, he's quite the character. Let's just put it that way. Which is kind of how it is in the mythology, though. I mean...
And they actually stole quite a lot from Greek mythology. Like, even the story of Heron. You replace his father being a king to being just a soldier returning from war, and you have the origin story of Hercules.
Yeah.
The origin story of Hercules is Zeus fell in love with a mortal woman, took the form of her husband whilst he was away from war, returned early, slept with her, and then left. And then her real husband returned home from war. She realized the mistake, immediately slept with him, and she became pregnant with twins, one of Zeus's descendant and one of her real husband's descendant.
Right.
So, I mean, that was just basically straight up stolen from Hercules.
Yep.
Credit for listeners out there. If you're not up on your Greek mythology and you're wondering about, is Heron have a real place? He does not. He was invented entirely for the show.
Yep. Exactly. One of my biggest complaints of this series, by the way, I'm going to just jump right into it because it annoyed me. They went through the trouble of blacksmithing a sword, a really cool sword, by the way, giving it to the bad guy. The gods continuously spoke about its abilities, talked about also continuously about the one who should wield this, and the season ended and Heron didn't even freaking get to hold it besides that one time in episode 3 and wield a sword. That was so frustrating
for me.
It's
weird because some of the promotional shots for it even shows him with the sword on his back.
Yeah, it was so weird.
I thought that was really weird. And the other thing that really kind of bothered me about this sword is Zeus is the one who forges it, and it's supposedly supposed to be so great and so strong it can even cut through anything made by Hephaestus. And I'm like, Zeus is not known for forging. It should have been Hephaestus who made the sword in traditional Greek mythology.
Yeah.
I mean, why is Zeus suddenly a forge master? He's not.
Right, exactly.
The other issue I had with that is they were trying to draw and demonstrate a traditional method for making steel. Even Heron tells the old man the ore is useless, and the old man's like, not if you know the secret of making steel. And then he proceeds to prep the ore for making the sword. Now, the method he was using is actually a method of making steel that was kind of a thing that had been discovered by a few cultures of the time, but not a lot. So if you knew it, you would definitely have an advantage in your armor and your swords.
Right.
But they made one key flaw in his preparation.
And what was that?
The pot was uncovered.
Why is that important?
It has to be a sealed clay jug to prevent oxidization of your minerals as the steel is forming.
Uh-huh. I don't know anything about blacksmithing, so I'm just going to take your word for it.
So, I appreciate the effort, but man, some flaws in there.
Come on.
You're having Zeus forging. You're not using Hephaestus. You don't seal your clay pot when you go to make your alloy.
Right. I mean, I know this is an animated series, but a little bit more realism is not going to hurt you.
What did you think of the reveal that the demon leader turns out to be Heron's brother?
I don't know. I felt like it was a little bit of an expected twist, you know?
Yeah. It's one of those things that when they first came up with the reveal, and I think Hera was the first one to tip that this was where they were going, when she's like, oh no, you're actually the son of a great king. I'm like, oh great, he's Heron's brother.
Exactly.
Like, my wife looked at me and be like, oh yeah, you're right. That makes sense. That's going to be cheesy.
Yeah, exactly. Here's what I have to say with regards to that storyline with the brothers, is that I felt like how they approached it was a little inconsistent. At first, it kind of seemed more like they were going to make an attempt to save him, you know, to sort of revert his, you know, the
redemption arc.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought it was going to go in that direction. And they sort of were starting to play it in that way.
Yeah, I definitely felt that a redemption arc was missing at the very end of the series.
And it didn't really go that way. What was weird is that Heron asked Zeus, hey, can we reverse that? Zeus is like, yeah, totally. But he has to want that.
Exactly.
And when Heron finally confronted Seraphim, or, you know, his brother, Heron made no attempt at saying, brother, come back. Let's build a new life, or let's do something.
Well, he did at one point tell him that Zeus could undo it.
Yeah, but that was like almost in passing. Like, by the way, Zeus can undo this.
Yeah,
but should we move over there to keep fighting?
Zeus can save you. And he's like, nope, sorry, I would rather keep fighting. We're all pawns of the gods, and I don't want to owe Zeus anything, so I'm going to keep fighting, even though that just makes me still a pawn of Hera.
Logic.
Seraphim was taken by his uncle, cast off the cliff and into the river, and rescued and went through that whole nursed by a bear thing and all that story, and who knows who was telling the truth of Hera trying to kill him with a bear, or Hera trying to save him with a bear, or Zeus being the one to turn the bear to feed him, whatever the case may be, right? I mean, neither one of those people in Greek mythology could be considered reliable narrators to tell the truth about such a story.
Let's just put it this way. All the gods in the Greek pantheon are shady AF.
They're just terrible people. I mean, they are not benevolent.
No, they're
rulers.
Not.
But the thing in that backstory, and correct, tell me if I missed this, because I could not figure this out. After he was cast off to die in the water, after he was saved and started to be raised amongst the bears and his adopted mother, how did his uncle ever discover that the baby survived and sent his sons after him to try and eliminate a potential claim to the throne?
That is an excellent question that was not revealed.
That was the only part that was like, why are they harassing this woman and this random child and that they are living in the wilderness? What possible reason could they have to know that he is the true heir to
now.
The throne?
I remember it was the sister. Okay. The sister of the woman who took him knew about it, and she still worked at the castle or the where the king lived, and she told on her sister. I remember now. That's how they found out.
Okay. I must have just missed that one. I think that could have gone with a number of these plot points, because this show is only 8 half-hour-long episodes.
It's really not a long series. This is not labeled as a limited series, so there is a possibility of obtaining or having a season 2 on this.
I don't think it's needed,
though. Absolutely not. They left the door open for sure.
I definitely think that a few more episodes, making it like, say, a 12 or 13 episode series, they could have dealt a little bit more in depth on some of these points. And I think we could have benefited from that.
Well, you know, here's the thing, though. You know, with Castlevania, for example, Castlevania had 4 episodes in the first season, 8 episodes in the second season, and 10 episodes in the 10th season, right? So season 2 of Castlevania was a much better season than season 1, but season 3 was a much better season than season 2, and I think having those extra 2 episodes really gave the writers a little bit more leg room to speak and expand more on the storylines. And I think that if there's going to be a season 2 of Blood of Zeus, I think having a 10 episode story arc like Castlevania season 3 is the way to go.
So yeah, it's there's room there, but hey, I could be wrong though, to be honest, because after season 2 of Castlevania, I was convinced that that show was done.
Absolutely.
What room is there for a season 3? And they brought in a season 3, and I love season 3. So, well, at the moment, I don't believe that there is a need for a season 2. If they do bring one in, and they do the same really impress me and blow me away as they did for season 3 of Castlevania, then I will bite my tongue and take back my words, because...
Yeah, no. I mean, I definitely wouldn't object to a second season. I would definitely be interested in seeing a season 2. Going back a little bit to the villains, though, speaking more about that, I feel like there was a little bit of an inconsistency in terms of trying to focus on who the true villain of this series was or this season. I feel like there was a lot of competing factions that it was difficult at times to tell who was really in charge and who was really playing who, which I think that in a certain way, that's kind of where the writers were going for. In terms of trying to wrap the story of each villain, I feel like they didn't really do a good job with that. I mean, Seraphim, for sure, they wrapped up his story. Who knows what happened to Hera? You know, once the dust kind of settled, she sort of disappeared after Seraphim cut off her arm. And then, of course, Hades ends up being villain at the end, you know, ends up showing up that he wants to do his own mischief. But in between Hera, Seraphim, and the Titans, there really is no cohesion when it comes to who the true villain of this season was. And having a central villain is always important in the telling of a story, especially in the telling of a story of a hero, right? Is you need to have a central villain. And at least for Heron, it seemed like Seraphim was that central villain. But, you know, it seemed rather small in comparison to the Titans and Hera and everything else that was happening.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly true. Having Hera as just the jaded, manipulating things and kind of starting the civil war of the gods, and then the gods having to come together to undo her resurrection of the giants. That is very true to the overall Greek mythology of the kind of thing that Hera might do to exact right. revenge on Zeus, because she was really not pleased with his thirst all the time. And Seraphim, he was a villain, especially in the beginning. He was just an outright cold villain with no redeemable qualities. And then they tried to give him redeemable qualities. And you're like, oh, I want more of a story with him. I want to see more of this. Lead me down this path. And they kind of didn't. So it was overall, the general feel of the villain just kind of failed on a couple different levels.
Yeah.
I think
that, again, this is the importance of having a central villain, having someone that's truly controlling everything. Right. For example, in Castlevania, again, just having it compared to Castlevania, as Castlevania being the closest animated series in Netflix that we can compare this to, Castlevania had a central villain in season two, Dracula, right? I mean, season one and two, Dracula was that central villain. And within his Dracula's organization or Dracula's cohort, there were different levels of villains that were there. And so I think that creating that dynamic really is what gave Castlevania that focus of the heroes going after the villain. Whereas here, we didn't really get that, the heroes going after the villain. It was the heroes trying to stop Seraphim from continuing to invade and continuing that plague of demons. But in truth, the Titans coming back to life were a much bigger threat than that. That focus of Heron's story being about stopping Seraphim and not focusing on the greater world-ending, world-ending threat that were the Titans. Yeah,
War
exactly.
Of the Giants.
So, again, I feel like that disconnect between who the hero's villain is and compare that to the actual greater threat, I think that didn't really connect it very well.
I find it interesting you keep wanting to refer to the Giants as the Titans. It kind of makes me wonder, what did you think of Hephaestus's creation being these clockwork automatons, including his little pet clockwork owl?
Yeah, no, that was cool. I thought that was brilliantly done.
I thought that was a rather wink and a nod towards the 1981 film Clash of the Titans.
Absolutely.
Didn't Hephaestus have a very similar mechanical owl in that movie?
Yes.
So yeah, they were definitely acknowledging that one. I know they remade Clash of the Titans. God, I have to say, that was a very forgettable film because I cannot remember if they brought that back in the remake.
Yeah. And I feel like the robots and all of that technology reminded me a little bit of Asgard.
That was actually one thing. When he did eventually go to Mount Olympus for his training and to awaken his demigod powers and his demigod strength, I was kind of conflicted. Did I want more of these gods are gods because they have some means of sci-fi advanced technology similar to the MCU's Asgard? Or more the gods are gods because of the magic?
Right? I think it was more magic than technology. In this case.
Yeah, in this case, it was definitely more magic. I mean, yeah, they had their connection with the clockwork automatons, but overall, it was just generally magic.
Yeah, for sure. You know what's interesting is that the creators and writers of this show, and I believe they're brothers, Charlie and Vlas Parlapanidis, these guys actually wrote Immortals back in 2011. I don't know if you remember that movie, but that movie actually is what kicked off at least the first film I remember seeing Henry Cavill in back in 2011.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen that one.
It's another film about Greek gods and all that, which I thought it was so funny that these two went from doing that to then doing something similar, but in an animated format. What did you think of the cast of Blood of Zeus? Some familiar names. There's actually a connection once again to the MCU. Actually, two connections to the MCU, technically.
Yeah, it's one of those things is, unless if it's a popular person from another animated show. So for instance, my wife and I have recently been watching Star Trek Lower Decks, and there was a character on the holodeck that I immediately recognized as the same voice actor from Wreck-It Ralph, Fix-It Felix Jr., which then I also recognize him as being the actor from 30 Rock. Unless if I can make that connection between animated films, I usually don't recognize voices.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there are definitely, definitely exceptions to the rule, right? I mean, for the anime fans out there, Stephen Blum, for example, I mean, it's a voice that's recognizable every time. Who can forget that super, super sexy voice of Spike Spiegel, right? I mean, come on. You can recognize that voice. I mean, again, there are certain exceptions such as that, right? But for the most part, I'm with you.
But again, that's a connection between animated films. So I didn't actually pick up on any connection to the MCU in this one.
So the first connection to the MCU is Jason O'Mara, who plays Zeus, right? He ended up appearing for a bit in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television series.
Okay, yeah. So he was one of the side characters for one of the seasons, wasn't he?
Yeah, he ended up being director of S.H.I.E.L.D., Jeffrey Mace. And then, of course, you know, Jeffrey Mace ended up being, you know, the Patriot, right? Which he ended up being a superhero in that series. And the other actor that connects to the MCU is Jessica Henwick, who played Alexia. Jessica Henwick played the role of Colleen Wing in Iron Fist, The Defenders, and Luke Cage.
Okay, yep. Now, I do actually recognize the Jessica Henwick name because she is said to be in the Matrix 4.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the news on that. That's really great. I'm excited for that.
Set to be released next year. Cross our fingers that we actually start getting movie releases again next year. I mean, that's definitely going to be one that's on our list
for sure
future episodes. So another minor role I was going to mention for Jessica Henwick was that she was a member of the X-Wing pilots in The Force Awakens.
That's right. She was, wasn't she? I forgot about that.
She's been in a lot of supporting roles.
She really has been. Absolutely.
It's always interesting when you have a character that it gets into a lot of supporting roles for projects that you watch and you follow. You get to a point that you've seen the same person's name pop up enough times. You're just like, why aren't they getting a lead role yet?
Yes, no, absolutely. I think that Jessica Henwick absolutely deserves a lead role in an American film. I know that she's been in quite a few foreign films. If we can get a Colleen Wing, you know, Disney Plus series, come on, Disney, you got to make that happen. She just got her powers too. Yeah. We want to see more of that.
I want to see a lot of things coming out of a lot of these franchises that she is very variously connected to. So let's chase it down. Let's see where we can go with some
absolutely.
Of this stuff.
All right, so Nathan, should we jump into our TLDL?
Too long, didn't listen.
All right, and this is a section where we give you our closing thoughts on the movies or TV series that we're speaking of on today's episode. So Nathan, Blood of Zeus, TLDL.
Blood of Zeus is going to appeal to a couple different audiences. One audience is going to be your anime fans that love violent war type story arcs. The other audience is going to be the people who absolutely love Greek mythology, but are willing to allow for reinterpretations and changes to the Greek mythology story. If you're the kind of person that loves Greek mythology and wants these stories told in Greek mythology, but must absolutely hold to the original stories as canon, this one's going to bother you a little bit. But if you're willing to allow it to have creativity, liberal license in how those stories are told, this one will be fun for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as you said, this animated series definitely has more action, at least in this first season, than Castlevania did. Castlevania tends to be a little bit more slow when it comes to the action. It's a lot more plot-driven and a lot more character-driven. This one has a lot more action in it. So if you like that, you're definitely going to like this one. Again, just as a reminder, it is very gory. Lots of gore, lots of blood. So just keep that in mind if you're not into that kind of stuff. Other than that, I think that the story is, I think, for the most part, well-crafted. I think that there's obviously some issues with the villains, as per usual. I mean, that seems to be a theme on most of the movies or TV series that we talk about that have a hero and a villain, is the villain tends to be the issue most of the time.
Definitely always need a better villain.
Exactly. Other than that, I think that this is a well worth investment. It's also not going to take much time out of your day. I mean, it's 8 episodes. The longest runtime for some of the episodes is 37 minutes. And there's, again, only 8 of them. And I think that, you should definitely check it out.
And with that, Dan, final question. I actually really felt bad for Seraphim at the very end when he had the choice of continue to be a pawn of Hades of the Underworld or suffer eternally. But which option do you think he chose?
I mean...
What do you think his ultimate answer is going to be?
That is a really good question. I want to say he probably took the Hades deal. Maybe he thinks he can find a way out of that deal or something. But hey, if you want to let us know what you think and what your predictions are, if there's going to be a season two of this series, definitely let us know by hitting us up on Facebook at
Streaming Thoughts and on Twitter at
Streaming Geek.
This has been Nathan.
And this has been Daniel.
Thank you for listening.